From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The 4th Earl of Chesterfield said it in 1748, "Speak of the moderns without contempt and of the ancients without idolatry." But contemporary cultural and social critics can often overlook Chesterfield's advice when debating and defining the various meanings of modernism and the modern. With that in mind, the National Humanities Center invited several scholars to discuss cultural and aesthetic modernism in a series of programs for Soundings. The speakers are Harvey Gross, James Olney, Stephen Marcus, Diane Leonard, and Kejia Yuen. Professors Marcus, Gross, Olney, and Yuen are scholars at the National Humanities Center, specializing in comparative literature, literary history, and criticism. Professor Leonard teaches comparative literature at the University of North Carolina. Here is Harvey Gross.
Suppose we were a group of English literary critics meeting, say, 1600 or 1580, and the question was put to us to characterize the Renaissance. Suppose we were to ask Philip Sidney or Ben Jonson, two of the distinguished literary critics of the period, would they know what we were talking about if we ask them to characterize the Renaissance?
I think the obvious answer is no, they wouldn't, because the term didn't think of that as what they were involved in. The term and the idea of the Renaissance was a much later phenomenon. But I suppose the question leads on to the contemporary position, where when we do use the term modernism, and we all suppose that we understand commonly what's meant by modernism, by way of contrast with the situation in 1580, say, where they did not know what was meant by Renaissance. They wouldn't have understood at all, I suppose, what was meant when they were asked to say, what is the Renaissance? What are the characteristics of the Renaissance? But what does that say about modernism? That we're very conscious about being modernist, being modern?
Yes, that's the point. I would certainly want to make that. The very fact that we come together and want to define modernism is an indication of the degree of self-consciousness that we all possess.
It's a particular kind, I think, of self-consciousness, because I don't think it would be correct to say that Ben Jonson and Sir Philip Sidney were not self-conscious in a certain way. You read their poetry and you confront very highly articulated kinds of self-consciousness.
Sophistication, certainly,
right.
Yes, highly.
So that I do think, however, that the kind of self-consciousness we're talking about when we speak about the Renaissance or about modernism is a specifically historical self-consciousness. That is, the category is itself a product of a kind of consciousness which is historical. It's historical, and therefore that is historical in the sense that it's developed in history, and at a particular time in history when the sense of history itself was undergoing a rapid and characteristically new development. And so only someone equipped with this historical and historicist, as you say, consciousness would be able to make sense out of the idea of the Renaissance on the one hand and modernism on the other.
When was it that the term the modern was first used? Is there an instance that you can point to, a date, a work, a time in which this self-consciousness actually had a beginning?
Modernus is a Latin word. It appears in the 6th century, I understand, according to meaning at that time, when I think Curtius mentions this in his study of the Latin literature of the Middle Ages, that modernus meant simply that which is happening now. So we would, this meaning of modern, we'd say contemporary, probably.
Yeah.
When does it first turn up in our time, in the terminology of modernism?
Harvey is referring to, as it were, the long-term normative use of the idea of modern, which just means contemporary. But I think that, for our purposes, perhaps one could there are a number of axial distinctions that one could make, and one of them, I think that I would suggest or throw forth perhaps for discussion, would be the distinction between the modern world on the one hand and modernism on the other, because they are not congruent or identical at all. That is to say, one can date the modern world, you know, as beginning at any number of places, starting from the Reformation, let's say, as Max Weber did.
To Galileo, to Descartes.
You could start in the 16th century with the Reformation, in the 17th century with the revolution in science, in the 18th century with the Enlightenment, at the end of the 18th century with the French Revolution, the Industrial Revolutions, and Romanticism. But you cannot date modernism, it seems to me, in the same way as you can date the origins of the modern world. So there is a real, as it were, difference of strata, as it were, or difference of pitches or levels of discourse when it comes to the idea of the modern world and modernism, although the terms are not unrelated.
If modernism is characterized by this historical self-consciousness, is there any point at which one can say that that begins? A self-consciousness about being at a certain point in history.
Well, Baudelaire talks about modern painting in 1860. He uses a term to refer. He writes a piece, I think, called "On the Modern Painters," and he uses the term pretty much. In a sense that we'd use
in
it.
Our sense. Which is very different from Ruskin's sense, isn't it? When Ruskin refers to modern painting, a very different sense. I don't think the Ruskins would be our sense of modernist, would it?
Diane, one?
Well, I think there's a difference, again, between modern and modernist, or modernism. And in Ruskin's time, when he defended Turner as a modern landscape painter, he meant a contemporary painter and one who had broken with the neoclassical norms of painting. And I think something of our own sense of the word modernism today retains that idea of opposing oneself to a certain codified set of norms. I certainly do think that novelists, for example, in the earlier part of this century were very self-consciously aware that they were breaking with tradition that they had inherited from the late 19th century in a very decided way, and in that sense that they were very self-conscious about what they were doing.
Well, I myself would say that there are, I fluctuate back and forth between two great, as it were, moments of change. One is the change that begins around the middle of the 18th century, with the break with the Enlightenment, with such figures as Rousseau and Blake and Wordsworth and the Romanticists, and the immense changes that are connected with the Industrial and French Revolutions, let's say, and the simultaneous introduction of the modern historical consciousness taking place at just that time. And the other are the set of changes that occur at the beginning of the 20th century in art and the arts in general.
The revolution in style.
The revolutions in style, which we locally think of as modernism. Now, these seem to me, as it were, continuous developments, although, again, for the purpose of discussion, it's very important to be able to isolate or talk about the modernist phase of this modern world. Now, if I could say just one more thing in this thing, one of the things that seems to bind these two things together, you know, as one very large phenomena in which you can talk about still distinct sub-phenomena, is the growing consciousness of change. That is to say, starting toward the end of the 18th century, there comes into our society, as it were, an awareness of ever-increasing change on a larger and more rapid scale. And this seems to me one of the characteristics of both the modern age and of modernism, too. That is
an acceleration of the historical process.
Right.
I'd like to agree with Stephen Marcus' delineation of these two separate phenomena that we might term modernist. Definitely there was a break around the late 18th century with Kant and philosophy and certainly in terms of literary tradition. And again, what is more typically known as modernism does occur at the beginning of this century. What I see is binding this movement, beginning with what we now call Romanticism, together, rather than just a sense of change, is an increasing involvement with questions of epistemology, problems of perception. Many of these are thematized in post-Kantian philosophy in various of its phases, culminate, and they culminate, it seems to me, in this century with the various kinds of modernist art and in philosophy with such movements as phenomenology. And so I would like to think in terms of emphasis on perceptual processes and a shift in our belief in being able to know anything objectively.
If I could pick up on this, and both of what Stephen Marcus and Diane Leonard have said, Goethe said that with Voltaire a world was ending, with Rousseau a new world was beginning, and I think there's a real truth to that, and the first step in this two-step process, if one can call it that. And it seems to me that with Rousseau, as against Voltaire, for example, to pick up Diane Leonard's term again, the epistemology becomes an inward-directed thing. What can be known, one finds this in Wordsworth, for example, in the Prelude, what can be known is something interior and from one's own experience and becomes much more subjective than it had been before. It's a subjective kind of knowledge rather than a knowledge of something objectively out there in the world. And it seems to me then with the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, and Diane Leonard has mentioned the novelist at the beginning of the 20th century, Virginia Woolf, for example, who says in 1910 human nature was drastically altered. It seems to me that not only is the knowledge that one can possess an interior and a subjective thing, but it becomes in the exterior world too for the people who are looking in this way. Everything becomes fragmented, progressively more fragmented, and they have a sense not only that the exterior world is fragmented, but their interior world is too. They have no longer secure control of that until, in our time, there's a denial of any kind of self or any kind of continuous consciousness.
I'd like to pick up on that date, 1910, for a moment, because you have almost simultaneously in all the arts an incredible change in syntax and in subject matter. In music, you have in 1909, Schoenberg publishes his three piano pieces, which are the first musical compositions without key center, that are thoroughly atonal. In 1909 or 11, Kandinsky paints the first painter of completely abstract paintings. And Eliot, with Prufrock in 1910, is writing a poem in which the narrative logic is disrupted and fragmented. Now, I know it's unfashionable to talk about zeitgeists, but it seems to me something is in the spirit of the time that's leading the painters, the poets, and the musicians in similar directions, syntactically and formally.
I think we should distinguish the modern from the modernism, because especially in the Western world, the concept of modern covers a large area. You can say even Dante is the first modern poet. while in China, modern starts very late. It starts with 20th century, with the revolution of 1911. So I think in our discussion and in our understanding of modernism, we had better concentrate on, or say put more emphasis on ism, modern ism. Yeah, what this ism represents.
Are you talking about artistic self-consciousness rather than, as Harvey has pointed out, a spirit of self-consciousness? Is it restricted simply to the poets and the painters and the musicians?
Well, modernity is a concept that's been used by cultural critics like Daniel Bell to describe not only the cultural products, that is the art, the music, and the literature of the period, but the lifestyle itself that has developed from the middle of the 19th century. And of course, Bell carries it down to the 60s, where he feels that modernity in this form is a malevolent, social disintegrating force that operates against the capitalist and middle class hegemony that is challenged, because it is one of the features of 19th century modernism to adopt this profoundly anti-middle class, anti-bourgeois, attitude, not only in art and literature, but in what we might call lifestyle, so that Marx's attack, Nietzsche's attack, Baudelaire's attack, the critiques of men are very different temperamentally and in what they were doing, Marx, Nietzsche, and Baudelaire, yet they all equally detested the middle class and the bourgeoisie.
Well, I think one has to distinguish one's categories here. And when we're talking about modernism, we're really talking about a cultural category, essentially in a very broad sense here, rather than economic, as it were.
I'm just saying the term could be used that way. I'm not sure how correct it is to use
it. And you paint with a rather broad brush when you use it as a general cultural category, which is one of the reasons why I think to break it up into smaller units may be useful in terms of discussion.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to part one in the Center's series on cultural and aesthetic modernism. The speakers are Stephen Marcus, Harvey Gross, James Olney, Kejua Yuen, and Diane Leonard. Professor Leonard teaches comparative literature at the University of North Carolina. Professors Marcus, Gross, Olney, and Yuen are scholars at the National Humanities Center, specializing in comparative literature, literary history, and criticism. Here is Stephen Marcus.
I would think that one of the things that characterizes the epoch that we're talking about, which may have its culmination in the modernist movements, let's say, because not
of the 20th century.
Of the 20th century. Is the accelerating notion of innovation, is the idea of newness or innovation. That is, it's a permutation of the idea of change, which we talked about before. But starting sometime, again, around the 18th century and the end of the 18th century, the notion that what is important is innovative, becomes a strikingly salient idea, as it were, in the modern world. I don't think that you find, let's say, before the end of the 18th century, the kind of premium being put upon the new, the innovative.
Original, the innovative.
The original, let's say.
That's that romantic, isn't it, Stephen? That's essentially romantic.
Yes, but it's essentially romantic, you're quite right, but it keeps growing all the time and becomes, as it were, a tenet. A first principle of modernism in the arts as
make it new, said
make
it new, as right. Ezra Pound said.
So right. What began as a characteristic quickly assumed a general category.
Now, I think one of the interesting things, however, is that this idea, which seems to be relatively controllable and benign and positive, as you see it in the Romantics and even in the novelists, let's say, of the 19th century, begins, as it were, let's say, at around the time of Nietzsche and post-Nietzsche, as it were, to begin to take on not so benign characteristics. That is to say, the idea of innovation becomes, as it were, assimilated to general notions of destabilization. That is to say, it's not as if you have innovation with a background or within a context of essentially continuous traditions in politics or society or this, but everything gets caught up, as it were, in a kind of whirlwind, as it were, of change. And so not only do the categories of art become unstable, but all the categories associated with the way you judge art, with the way you think about art, with the way you think about culture, and therefore with the way you think about how to live, also become similarly destabilized, and we are the inheritors of that very problematical legacy.
Which is why the deconstructionists make Nietzsche their patron saint.
Indeed it is.
That's where they take the notion of this, the necessity of newness, of radical innovation.
But Nietzsche at the same time was profoundly afraid of these forces as well. So Nietzsche is always a kind of ambivalence. I mean, he talked about nihilism as the creeping force that was going to destabilize Europe. Yet at the same time, he was he was part of this destabilizing element. Keijio, would you?
I think that the idea of originality of the 19th century is quite different from the originality of what we call now modernism of the 20th century. Edward Young's conjecture on original composition was perhaps one of the earliest statements of the 19th century idea of originality. But I think the main difference between the 19th century concept of originality is that at that time, originality was used as a means to express the writer's ideas. While in 20th century, I think, for instance, in Joyce or in Joyce Finnegan's Wake, well, the idea of originality became an end in itself. I think there is this difference between the two.
I think it's a paradox, too, in the question of the need for innovation and for making it new in the 20th century. The paradox being that the reason that they felt that they had to make it new, at least I think this is true of people like Eliot, for example, was that they felt what Walter Jackson Beatty has called the burden of the past. The past was so heavy on them, and there was nothing, unless they could make it new, there was nothing more to say, as I think Eliot very clearly felt. And so somehow he had to take tradition and by whatever means, make it new. Otherwise, he just would be repeating.
This is an interesting feature of modernism, I think, in the sense that art forms, genres, the material of poetry and music and art become exhausted. That is, Eliot remarked that after Milton, nobody could write blank verse in English, that Milton had did everything that was possible to do in blank verse. So if you were to write a long poem after Milton, you could not write one in blank verse. And similarly, Mann and Dr. Faustus has the devil expresses this, but that the composer at the turn of the 20th century had used up tonality to the extent that it no longer was a medium that could express what had needed to be expressed at that time, so that the composer was simply historically driven to break up the traditional harmonic system and do something else. Similarly, The apologists for free verse made the same claim, that metrics, the metrical composition and metrical form was simply no longer possible because everything that had been done had already been done. So at the sense of, as you say, the burden of the past is certainly an important component. Diane?
Oh, I'd like to agree with Harvey Gross to some extent in the way you've just delineated this. The sense of the burden of the past, but it seems to me that the drive to make it new came less from a sense that the past had exhausted the possibilities of the tradition than from a sense that one had to make it new in order that one could experience it finally, and a breaking away from the old concepts of imitation and a break with the whole Aristotelian heritage. And it seems to me that from the late 18th century on, we've had a succession of revolutions against those old forms, beginning with Romanticism. We have realism, in a sense, revolting against Romanticism, and then we have modernism reacting against realism. But I think in every case, there is an underlying common impulse here of defamiliarizing, of making strange, of roughening and impeding and breaking up and making difficult in order that we may perceive things anew. So I come back to my own emphasis here in my view of modernism, which is that it is always an attempt to make us focus on the process of perception rather than looking at an object and imitating it. In other words, it is a making problematic, the whole question of perceiving of how we know. And I see this is involved, this being the very root and core of this urge to make it new. It's not innovation in my own opinion for its own sake, or originality for its own sake, but a saying that the past has become, well, Shklovsky had a wonderful phrase. He said that the old forms affect us no more than putting a coin into a slot machine and having a candy bar come out. That's the way the language that we're too habituated to works in our own perceptual processes. So we have to make language tortured and impeded so that we don't get it automatically.
But this would again, as it were, locate the watershed, or the first watershed, back in Romanticism, because what, let's say, Blake and Wordsworth and the other Romantics were trying to do, as they said, was to restore the sense of wonder to the world, which is the first installment of defamiliarization. That is to say, the cultural categories had grown stale, so to speak. People had ceased to perceive the actuality of the world because they were perceiving through dead cultural categories.
Like the stylized poetic diction.
Like 18th century Miltonics, let's say, instead of the naive kind of new verse, that childlike verse that Blake and Wordsworth were trying to write, to open, to cleanse the doors of perception, as Blake would say. So that the first installment, as I said, of this idea of defamiliarization is with the Romantics. However, it seems to me that by the time you get to the Romantics and their followers in the 19th century, and here it seems to me we do have a difference between the 19th century version of creativity in the modern world and what we call modernism, the Romantics and their successors were, as it were, working in and against a social and class and economic situation which was itself more clear, more identifiable, and more stable than what the world was like 100 years later. That is to say, the world that the artists are writing in the beginning of the 20th century, is itself a more problematical one than the world 100 years earlier was. It's not as clear, as it were, to the early 20th century writers. They know that they have to do a lot of negation, that there's a great deal of negating and criticism and criticizing that has to be done. But it seems to me that their sense of social location and of what they might affirm, as it were, in the social and economic world is much slimmer and much more problematical than that of their predecessors 100 years earlier.
Well, that's because I would think that behind Wordsworth, for instance, was the French Revolution.
Exactly.
A very clear
historical
watershed. I mean,
that he experienced and identified with and had a very, very profound experience of. Right.
And the other great artists of the period, Hegel and Beethoven, were also supremely conscious of the great historical change that had taken place within their lifetime.
Right. Now, here I would agree with you. It would seem to me that although the later group of writers, the modernist writers, who insist, as you say, upon originality, and insist upon it even more stridently in some sense than the first generation of Romanticists, and are original, are at the same time ambiguous, because it's not ever clear with the modernist writers like Eliot whether the insistence upon originality is accompanied by the sense that they're at the end of something. That is, the world is becoming exhausted, and they're being original because they're at the end of a line, so to speak, and there's very little left except to innovate in art. There's a difference between that and, let's say, Rousseau and Blake and Beethoven, who are really looking forward to the beginning of a new world of some kind.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to listen this week to part one in the Center's series on cultural and aesthetic modernism. What are the meanings of modernism and the modern from literary, philosophical, and critical viewpoints? Listen for answers and insights this week on Cultural and Aesthetic Modernism, Part 1, from the National Humanities Center and Soundings.